This is Pure Decking for Thursday. What is today? August 1st, 2019. This is show number 359. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game. And as a reminder, if you're starting off your meeting invite with, "I'm sorry, I'm scheduling this through lunch, but it's the only open time on your calendar," you're the asshole. Not me for having a full calendar. It's you. But I'm not bitter. I'm Morps. Tonight, I am drinking Knob Creek. And I have Madman. Madman, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a Line and Kugel Summer Shandy. And it sounds like this may have happened once or twice.
Potentially every day this week. We have Static. Static, what are you drinking?
I have Bird Dog Whiskey and Not Your Father's Root Beer. I'm drinking combinations of both.
Nice. And finally, we have BSV. BSV, what are we drinking?
Sadly, water.
You're the RU of the week.
Yeah, we're going to need you to speak with an Australian accent, say cunt a lot. And I'm not quite certain how to characterize his political views, but we're just going to need you to go ahead and take that on. So, anyways... Let's get the stories back up here because I was screwing around at the soundboard trying to find the Alex Jones song. Okay, so we're going to start things off. Lead story tonight is, of course, about Capital One because, they haven't made it.
Yes.
shit ton of work for me. Anyways, didn't realize there were more hosts. Rats, we've got a whole crew of people we used to rotate in and out. There's really only one people out of the regular group that I might have banned from the show, but I had my reasons. Anyways, usually it's just who shows up and feels like doing it.
We all have our reasons for him.
Yeah, when he hooked the stream into a Google Talk and then a bunch of people I didn't know started coming through his microphone. The fuck? So,
no, but it's cool, man. It's cool.
He turned it into a call-in show.
Yeah, thanks for the warning. So, anyways. So, go ahead and cover Capital One here because it's literally every other story in the freaking feeds. So... Capital One found out about its 106 million customer data breach only because a member of the public emailed it a tip. Nobody's reading the logs. So they get some bullet points here. Capital One's data was breached sometime between March and July, and 106 million people had some combination of their ID, social security number, and bank account information compromised. The bank didn't know about the hack until a member of the public emailed it to say details of the hack had been posted to GitHub. The Department of Justice said. Company reported the breach to the FBI 2 days later. Why did you wait 2 days if it was on GitHub? I could see waiting.
They needed to talk to their lawyer.
Yeah. But, I mean, I'm thinking the lawyers at that point are going to be telling you, okay, you need to notify the FBI ASAP because the clock is ticking now that you know about it. Yeah. Tips like this are a common way for companies to find out about security breaches. The DOJ has charged a former software engineer with hacking Capital One's security systems, accusing her of taking the data and posting it online. There were some people who thought that maybe this person didn't think they were even doing anything wrong because apparently this system was not difficult to breach. So that's kind of up in the air, but it's going to end up in court. But I've seen more and more articles saying that this is really Capital One's fault, that, you know, not that somebody hacked into them.
But sir, the passwords were right there.
So, although you know, if you go to the underpass in the bad part of town and find the Lambo with the keys left in it, you know damn well they intend for somebody to steal that car. It's still going to get charged with theft if you get caught stealing that car.
Has any word come out on how she got into the system?
Yeah, there's been a few different articles on it. It was all stored, all the data was stored in an S3 bucket, and there was one particular Amazon role that gave them gave access to pretty much everything in that bucket. And apparently she was able to bounce off their WAF in such a way that she assumed that role through their web app. So I wonder if it has more details in this article. I don't think it does. Capital One was made aware of its enormous data breach by somebody who emailed the company after seeing the details of the hack freely available online. The American bank announced Monday that it had been breached, affecting 106 million people in the U.S. and Canada. Many of those people had Social Security numbers, linked bank accounts, and other personal information compromised. The Department of Justice has arrested Paige A. Thompson, a former software engineer, and charged her with a single count of computer fraud and abuse. The DOJ said the breach took place between March and July. The criminal complaint accuses her of stealing data from Capital One's cloud provider and posting details of the hack on GitHub, a project managing site popular among developers. Those details included various commands that Capital One later verified could be used to obtain its data, according to the complaint. Oh, so she had the commands just posted on the GitHub. It must have been pulled down before I really started looking into it, because I didn't see that anywhere. The complaint also includes the detail that Capital One didn't realize it had been hacked until somebody tipped it off. According to the DOJ, somebody emailed the bank on July 17th saying there appears to be some linked S3 data of yours in someone's GitHub/gist. S3 refers to Amazon Web's cloud storage product for developers, which Capital One used to store the data that was breached. According to the complaint, Capital One contacted the DOJ 2 days later on July 19th to report the breach. The GitHub file in question was timestamped April 21st and was linked to Thompson's name. Well, that's smart. Yeah, here's all this stuff. I think you just post it from my own account. That's, you know, my name. The person's name and other identifying information were redacted by the DOJ complaint. In a statement, Capital One described the person as an external security researcher. So somebody like me who goes through and Google Dork's GitHub occasionally for fun, you know, came across this. Which, by the way, Google Dork and GitHub is great. Great fun if you know a little bit about scripting, because you'll find shit like you'll find S3 accounts and keys and SSH, you know, passwords and all kinds of shit in people's GitHubs because they don't realize they're public half the time, or they don't think about what all's getting synced up. What's really fun is when you find people's database credentials for the website that they're hosting, and then they've got the code posted online and they haven't scripted any of that crap out of it. So I'm not saying abuse that data. I'm just saying it's really fun to find. And if you're a good person, you might notify them that, hey, you got something in your GitHub you might want to take care of. But here's the really fun part about that. When you do see people who've noticed it, a lot of times they'll just, you know, go into GitHub and redact that file. But you can go see the changes, because you can compare previous versions. A lot of times you can go find where they've redacted it and you find the previous version. It hasn't been changed. So, but there's entire books out there on Google Dork and GitHub. So good times. Don't abuse it, I think I should say. You're supposed to say that, things like that, right? Like, oh, educational purposes only, don't abuse it. We're just pointing and laughing. We would never actually do something harmful with this. Is that all the things the lawyers say we're supposed to say?
I think so. Let me check the list again.
Yeah. We don't endorse these actions. We merely find them entertaining.
Thank you, Madman, our closest substitute for a lawyer.
Oh, God, we're all going to prison one day.
Yes, we are.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking, without really knowing, other than they're storing this in an S3 bucket, why the hell would a bank store anything in an S3 bucket?
You can actually lock them down pretty well. You can, if you take the time. In the past few years, Amazon's put a lot of work into getting the Cycross. We don't bring up the disclaimer on this show. We don't let that thing in here. It is scary. Cycross says, "Ask the disclaimer." We're not going there. We're not that desperate yet. it's not uncommon for people to use S3. Either because they're developers, yep, Rats just beat me to it in the IRC, because the developers like it, so that that's just the solution they design. It is easier if you don't have a lot of infrastructure already to stand up things like S3 buckets for web apps. If you already have a whole lot of infrastructure and your own storage, that's great. The real nice benefit to an S3 bucket, though, is you don't have to worry about filling it up. There is
maybe
a cost.
I'm crazy. I just thought a lot of banks already had internal infrastructure for this and, you know, securely stored their customer information.
Well yeah, but AS400s are expensive as balls to maintain. So most banks are still running on, like, actual mainframes. Or at least IBM Power Systems emulating mainframes. You know, running software that they paid $1 million for in the 70s, written in COBOL or Fortran. And I always thought,
hey, we're getting our money out of it, damn it.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is. Or it's because it's so esoteric, nobody knows how to get the data out of it and into a modern system. So,
hey, those guys outlived their usefulness and were properly fired years ago.
It's not uncommon to hear of banks calling up, you know, developers who've been retired for years because nobody else knows that system or language. And a lot of these mainframes, I mean, it's not like today where you can go grab a handful of cloud experts, Java experts, and get, you know, and give them a few weeks to get up to speed with your systems and get them going. You know, if you're willing to pay for them, or you can do what most companies do and hire, you know, interns and college grads who take a lot longer because they don't actually know their craft yet. They're still learning it. Or, you know, they hire self-taught people or the boss's son who claims he knows it, but that's a different argument. Yeah. Anyways, so, you know, yeah, you could bring in a group of consultants to get up to speed on modern systems, but these AS400s, they're like our nuclear plants, man. Each one is a special, unique snowflake. They all have their own parts, and they're expensive as balls to maintain. And you never hit them with a network scanner because they will fall over. Or so I've been told. It probably worth, you know, truthfully, it would probably be really worth it if you wanted to take the time to do it, to learn AS400 mainframes, mainframe architecture, because they have their own architecture and terms, and a lot of them, I mean, they're analogs to, you know, the same things you'd see at like a Linux box, right? But, you know, if you go around saying, oh, you mean a directory, or you mean an ACL to, you know, old school mainframe guy, you'll probably get shanked in the parking lot. So, and there are differences. I'm oversimplifying a little bit because a lot of these mainframes really do put a lot more controls and things in place. But if you took the time to learn that in COBOL, Fortran, and then go around as a legacy systems expert, you probably would make bank. So, yeah, you know, anybody looking for a career change, that might be worth doing. But Rats in the IRC says he doesn't even want to think about what fuzzing would do to a nuclear control system. I doubt those things have the kind of network connection that you would need to fuzz them. If you're talking about the ones that are like still using the old school, you know, 8-inch floppies, where they had to buy stock, they had to buy back a whole bunch of old stock of them because nobody makes them anymore. And so they just bought, the military actually bought a whole bunch of these things of new old stock to you know, store because it can't get them anymore. Which apparently, I remember this too, some of the earlier models of floppy disks back when they still cost money. You know, they weren't as shitty as everybody remembers. It's the last ones we all used, you know, what, high school, where they got stupid cheap and would just fall apart.
I stopped buying them. I would just format the ones AOL sent.
Yeah, that was a good way to do it, too. Just peel that sticker right off, and there you go. Over serial or something, though? I mean, yeah, you could fuzz over a serial port, but it's probably going to be a console at that point, so I don't know that it's worth doing. Anyways, I mean, but that's what I mean about these things all being unique. Like, I can make the assumption that you might be able to do it over a serial port, but maybe on that system you can. Maybe they're actually doing network traffic on a serial line on that one, but not on, like, these three other ones. system interrupts for PS2. No, dude. No, we're not talking about desktop rigs here, man. We're talking about actual mainframes. or at least IBM Power Systems emulating them, but anyways. Capital One has an email address to which people can flag suspected vulnerabilities in systems. Many other banks have, you know, usually you can just email abuse or security at whatever bank's domain, and it'll probably get in there. Vacuum tubes. Yeah, we might be talking about, you know, depending on the bank, we might be talking about systems where debugging actually involves a can of Raid. let's see. Some of the people who email the hotline are white hat or ethical hackers or experts in computer security systems who report security vulnerabilities to their owners rather than try to exploit them. Based on Capital One's description, that may have been the case here. Thompson is due to appear in court on a Thursday, so that's actually today. If convicted, she could face fines up to 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. So, the scary part here is that a company the size of Capital One didn't know that all of this data had left their control until somebody told them about it. And, you know, good on the person for telling them so quickly, because if it was only up for a few months before somebody notified them, I mean, it's hard to say that something bad hasn't happened with that data because, you know, it was on the internet, but there's a chance that it hasn't.
And I know technically they're a victim, but is it getting to the point where we just need to write some legislation saying if you are a financial institution or a credit broker and your shit gets pwned, you're fucked?
I don't know that it needs to be written from that angle. I think the way it needs to be approached is that if you are a custodian of financial data, now you can get real technical on the definition of that if you want to, but for purposes of this conversation, banks, right? You know, the kind of information you could use to fuck somebody's life up. So
banks and credit bureaus.
Pure credit bureaus, mortgage companies, financial service companies, that kind of shit, right? So we can be general about this. If they go to write the law, they need to actually be specific about it, but that's neither here nor there. That you have a duty of care of this data and that your systems have to meet a level of security. You can get real esoteric and technocratic about these definitions, or you could be super vague. And in either way, it's probably going to be ineffective, because if you make it super technical and super specific about what all they have to do, you're going to end up with people building to a checklist, which in an industry that moves as quickly as cybersecurity does, that's not really going to be great. But if you're making it so so vague that anybody can just write the policies and define themselves into compliance, that's not really useful either. And I'm not a lawyer. We just declared you were the closest thing we had, Madman, so you can help me figure out the legal language there. But yeah, I don't know where the middle ground on that one is. But it does need to be, I mean, yeah, Cycross is talking about, like, with HIPAA, where they've defined due diligence, and you know, they've got some pretty serious regulations around healthcare data. You could do something similar with financial data, and you're going to have almost every bank out there lobbying against it because of the cost of doing that kind of thing. So,
well, even with HIPAA, I don't know if a hospital was using H3 buckets if they would be liable for anyone getting into them.
They absolutely would be.
The way HIPAA is written, you have a fine per record. I forget what it is. It's like $15,000 or something like that.
$50,000.
Okay, thank you. It's a pretty hefty fine per record that was breached. So, you know, HIPAA is there's all these standards you have to meet, but if you're breached, you can be fined this amount for each record. I'm not aware of anybody actually getting hit like that. They usually settle with is the FTC? Or maybe it's DOJ.
I actually don't know what regulatory agency it's with.
Whatever agency it is, I think there's a few that settled with them because when you actually do up the fines on some of these. But, you know, if you applied something like a HIPAA fine to Capital One here, so, I mean, you might be talking about more money than exists in a fine. That was the problem with all the DMCA laws where they would say, this person has pirated 100 million songs, and we want to do the full fine for every single one of them. It's like, yeah, that much money doesn't exist. So
we believe we would have made more money than existed if they didn't steal it.
Yeah, the way capitalism works, you can actually or make that argument. We're going to laugh at you because, no, you're not. Nobody's going to buy that many copies of, you know, that music or movie or whatever it is, but... you know, sure, you can say that much wealth might have been created. So I don't know. There's different ways to go about it because, yeah. At the same time, you know, what do you do? Do you go to your Amazon development team at Capital One and just fire them all for incompetence? I mean, maybe. That might actually be the right move here, that you might have somebody in there who's, you know, been promoted to incompetence and does not need to be making those decisions. But, you know, a lot of times it's a lot more nuanced than that. I know at my own job, you can very clearly see, I just need to click these four things over here and it'll fix the problem and make it go away. But there's so many layers of audit and change management that getting the permission to click those four little buttons to make the problem go away is a real pain in the ass. So you either have people who decide, screw process, I'm just going to fix it. And that works up until the first time somebody fixes it, or, you know, fixes it good, so to speak. You know, it's like, yeah, that quick little fix, and we have, you know, half a day of downtime. And, you know, each hour of downtime is worth X million dollars. So, you know, it kind of swings around and around, you know. So you will end up a lot of times with people who know that something's wrong, but they won't say anything because of the shitstorm between auditors, risk management, and everything else and getting it fixed, which is likely what happened with Equifax. And then they tried to blame one guy for it. It's like, well, yeah, here's the guy who does the updates. That was his fault. And, you know, try to fire the one guy and make it his fault. So, I don't know.
I'm just pissed I'm not going to get my $125 now.
Yeah, that's a thing. Like, yeah, Capital One put out a fake story saying, oh, yeah, no, register here and we'll give you $125. And the registration link was, like, actually agreeing that you're not going to sue them. Actually, I think they pulled that trick before with the whole the form you could use to check with Equifax to see if you were breached. By checking to see if you were breached, you were agreeing not to sue them for being breached. I mean,
yep.
Yeah. So, but somebody was saying Equifax was going to pay everybody who was breached $125. It's like, great, that pays for like what, a month and a half of identity protection? I mean, come on.
What? They say take the identity protection now instead is what they're telling people to do.
Yeah, the identity protection provided by the company they own.
Yep.
I guess it's something, but yeah. Anyways.
Everyone should just put a credit freeze on their own credit. It makes it a bitch to apply for a loan, but if you're wanting a loan, it's worth the extra paperwork to make sure that no one is fucking your credit except for you.
Pretty much, man. I mean, it's... I think we've predicted before that at some point everyone's going to have their data breached, and they're just going to need to come up with a different system for identifying people, because socials and, you know, government ID just doesn't seem to cut it anymore.
And the funny thing is, the Social Security number was never meant as an identification number. That's why your picture's not on it.
It was never even meant to be a secret. It was just meant to be an account number. So, I don't know. Next article. This is from Forbes. I don't think we're going to read the whole thing. The encryption debate was back in the news this week as Attorney General William Barr rallied against warrant-proof encryption that he argued protects criminals and terrorists. You know, this started my whole rant last week where I was going on and about encryption. And I went back and looked at what Cykros was trying to say about one-time pads. And yes, where he was coming from was correct, but that was not anywhere near the argument I was talking about. So it's fine. Anyways, warrant-proof encryption protects criminals and terrorists, continuing the same arguments that have been made for almost 30 years. The cybersecurity community dismissed Barr's demands and outlined the myriad of ways in which such backdoors could easily be exploited by criminals. And the sad reality is that most of the cybersecurity community has missed is that the encryption debate is already over. Facebook ended it earlier this year. Well, only if you're using Facebook. The encryption debate is typically framed around the concept of an impenetrable link connecting two services whose communications the government wishes to monitor. The reality, of course, is that the security of that encryption link is entirely separate from the security of the devices it connects. True. The ability of encryption to shield a user's communications rests on the assumption that the sender and the recipient's devices themselves are secure, with the encrypted channel being the only weak point. Again, true. After all, if either user's device is compromised, unbreakable encryption has little relevance. Sure, you just capture everything on the compromised device, and you'll have probably both sides of the conversation, right? And if the device itself is rooted, what's it matter? So while surveillance operations typically focus on compromising end devices, bypassing the encryption debate entirely. If a user's clear text keystrokes and screen captures can be streamed off their device in real time, it matters little that they are eventually encrypted for transmission elsewhere. Historically, compromising end devices was an expensive and complex process powered by a cat and mouse game with hardware manufacturers and software vendors to find vulnerabilities that could be used to remotely install them and then acquire the necessary device privileges. True. So far, this author's doing good. Such efforts are hard to scale, and the more devices that are compromised, the more likely the vulnerability is to be discovered and patched. To solve this problem, Facebook announced earlier this year preliminary results from its efforts to move a global mass surveillance industry directly onto users' devices where it can bypass the protections of end-to-end encryption. In Facebook's vision, the actual end-to-end encryption client itself, such as WhatsApp, will include embedded content moderation and blacklist filtering algorithms. These algorithms will be continually updated from a central cloud service, but will run locally on the user's device, scanning each clear text message before it is sent and each encrypted message after it's decrypted. The company even noted that when it detects violations, it will need to quietly stream a copy of the formerly encrypted content back to its central servers to analyze further, even if the user objects, acting as a true wiretapping service. Facebook's model entirely bypasses the encryption debate by globalizing the current practice of compromising devices by building those encryption bypasses directly into the communication clients themselves and deploying what amounts to machine-based wiretaps to a billion users at once. As the current status of this work and where it might be deployed in production, in a version of WhatsApp, a company spokesperson declined to comment. So, basically, yeah, he's right. The author here is right. And basically, they're saying that companies like Facebook are just going to put the content moderation and snooping directly into the application and not worry about trying to crack the encryption between device to device. Which, would give the government what they want and also completely defeats the point of encrypting it device to device. Because you're sending it out clear text somewhere else.
So pretty much Facebook is saying, if you bank on your phone, don't have the Facebook app on your phone.
Or WhatsApp or Instagram or any of the other applications that Facebook owns. They're probably not the only company that's going to be doing this, so you're going to need to, if you're truly concerned about it, we need to watch out what applications you're running and who actually owns them and whether they have a history of putting this kind of shit in there. Of course, Facebook.
So you're saying I need two phones.
Yeah, there you go. Or a phone and a tablet.
Yeah.
So, virtual machines on phones. That's what we need. Be able to spin up a virtual machine on the fucking phone.
Oh. You won't be able to do your taxes on your computer if you also use Facebook on your computer.
Oh, Rat says he sent me an, what's this, decking in VR. What did he send me here? He sent me screenshots of his Oculus desktop with the IRC. Nice. And what the player looks like, I think. That's cool. That's cool. Yeah, cubes for phones. That would be awesome. I don't know that you actually need a full-on virtual machine. I mean, anything where you could do that kind of a application sandbox and keep the data separate is really what you would need. So, and there are some things that do it, but yeah, I mean, if you're relying on WhatsApp encrypted messages to protect your privacy, you know, Facebook doesn't exactly have a great track record on that. So, yeah, I wouldn't be using WhatsApp thinking it's secure, even if it is doing end-to-end messaging. And any country or any company that's providing a end-to-end encrypted messaging system, Oculus, a Facebook company. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right, Psychros. We're just going to need to start examining all the traffic leaving a phone and figuring out what apps are phoning home constantly. Although Facebook's a great example, because if you go in and disable Facebook on your phone, watch how much longer your battery lasts. That alone's a good indicator. I'm not even kidding. Like, the Samsung phones come with it built in. So if you go in and disable, you can't uninstall it. It's part of the freaking base image. But you can go in, at least with package disabler, and turn it off. And one, it's interesting what apps quit working when you disable all of Facebook's crap. Mainly Oculus, actually, because I have a Gear VR, and it does not behave correctly if you've got all the Facebook crap disabled. It breaks it pretty badly. Two, your battery will last a little bit longer. Like, it's pretty noticeable, actually. So, yeah. But I like what he's saying here. Basically, he's saying that a lot of these endpoints are going to end up being rooted anyways because so many people are doing telemetry and you know, snooping on your device through the apps that the end-to-end encryption may not even matter.
It didn't come pre-installed on my phone.
I don't know what phone you have, but I know on mine it did.
A Samsung J3 Star.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's only on certain lines that they're doing it.
You said that, I'm like, I wonder, is it on my phone? And pulling it up just to double check, and yeah, didn't come.
So you searched through your apps and just didn't see Facebook, or did you actually?
Yeah, I've just searched through my apps and didn't see Facebook.
Doesn't matter. Now you've set it around your phone, so it doesn't store it.
Oh God, I think it does that. I had the GPS turned on my phone, and forgot to flip it off after I was done with the GPS app. On my lunch break last week, I went to Chick-fil-A, and as soon as I got back to my desk, I got a text message wanting to know if I wanted to review Chick-fil-A.
Well, the location services will get turned back on all the fucking time. But what you probably ran afoul of is, do you leave the Wi-Fi on your phone enabled?
It's enabled right now, yes. So sometimes I do.
So what you probably did was you probably left the Wi-Fi enabled, and it was able to grab, because companies sell this shit, we've talked about it, where they actually monitor the Wi-Fi and the Bluetooth of devices and tie them to users one way or another. And if they can ID the device, you know, oh, you were just in a, you, they can know that you were just in a Chick-fil-A, because somehow or another, they have somehow tagged whatever identifier they're using on the, either their Wi-Fi or their Bluetooth with your phone and your phone number.
I have fun with those, though. I leave it on purpose when I get those random, you know, invites to review. I leave absolutely abysmal reviews.
Oh, hell. I have to remember to turn the NFC off after every update, because the Samsung Pay app likes to flip it back on. And I've discovered a lot of restaurants have NFC tags built into their tables for one reason or another. Like Panera Bread does it so you can order from the app and not have to get up, which I'm not installing their fucking app on my phone. They already have enough, you know, enough crap, but it'll sit there. Like if I set my phone on the table, it'll sit there and keep trying to reopen that app if you forget to turn off the NFC stuff again. And every update likes to turn it back on for, you know, Samsung Pay or whatever the hell it is. So, although I was meaning to play with that, because I've got one of those, privacy, where you can generate, you know, one-time use credit cards and limited use credit cards. I was thinking that might be interesting to see if you could put one of those credit cards into, the Samsung Pay, so you'd have a way of using the one-time use of the generated credit card numbers out of privacy, like at an actual store, not just online. So, the Librem phones, I'm aware of them, but I haven't really done a deep dive on them, and I certainly don't have one. So, anyways, but you guys have anything more on that? We ready to move on?
Yeah, I think we're good to go.
Yeah.
All right, next article is from Bleeping Computer. North Carolina County lost $1.7 million in a email business compromise scan. After falling for a BEC scam, Carabas County in North Carolina lost $1,728,082.60 after sending $2.5 million to scammers pretending to be contractors building the county's new high school. BEC, or Business Email Compromise Fraud Schemes, are scams where crooks deceive employees of privately held companies and public organizations into wiring money to entities they trust, but whose bank accounts were changed to ones controlled by the criminals. Carabas County fell for this type of scam when they received a phishing email stating that the bank account for Branch and Associates, the contractor building their new high school, had been changed and that the county should use it for all future invoice payments. After receiving documentation that looked legitimate, the county changed the banking information that they would send payments. The scammers then waited for the county to make their next vendor payment, which amount allowed them to steal, you know,
the routing number and account number for their checking account.
Yep. So, well, it, they actually get the money. And in many cases, when this happens, it's usually not like the county that was hacked. It's the contractor. What's happened is somebody, I mean, there's a couple of places this happens. Mortgage brokers have this problem too, and they have it a lot more because they do wire transfers a lot more often. But what a lot of times will happen is the contractor or the realtor or whoever your middleman is in the agreement, they'll be the ones who get their email popped, right? And the bad guys will sit in that email box for a few weeks, a few months, however long it takes to get themselves a few copies of quote unquote typical, typical messages on this and to see what this company looks like when they do, you know, send out notices about a change of a bank account, if they can find one. They also just dig through the email archives, because if you're on like a Gmail or another system or Office 365, something where you don't have to delete your email all the time, you know, there's still a few companies out there running on-prem exchanges where you have like a max message mailbox size of 250 meg or something silly like that. But most people are running much larger systems where they're smaller companies and they just live off like a Gmail account or a Google Business account or whatever. So you don't ever delete anything. So they'll go back through that history and they'll find legitimate examples of what it looks like when they send you when that company sends something out saying, hey, our banking account information is now this, use this for this job. Or like when they send out the setup for a new customer, it's like, here's the, you know, the account number to use for the wire transfers for payments. And they'll just Photoshop it with whatever number they want. And, you know, they'll usually have a mule or somebody go set up an actual bank account somewhere else. And, you know, when I say a mule, that's a drug trafficking term, but it's somebody who doesn't realize they're working for a criminal. It's somebody who's just answering an ad online, who's like, oh yeah, I'm supposed to, they have a job as a money mover, and they'll think that they're doing account management or something where they're supposed to open up a new bank account and move things from one account to another account. Well, what they're doing is facilitating money laundering, and they just don't know it because they think they're working online.
I believe that term's a smurf.
Yeah, smurf works too.
But you don't even have to do it that way. This is contractors for the government are public record. Just get an email close to the net company name. Or if you control a domain, the company name with just instead of .com, .whatever. Send the email to a county clerk saying, here's the new billing information.
Very much, yeah. That happens.
If they
too.
Don't call and check, I've known of mortgage brokers, like real estate agents, pretty much the middleman for buying a house.
Yep.
They've had to call and verify where to send funds because they've gotten fishy emails like that and just didn't notice that there was an extra letter in the name of the bank. Like, no, nothing's changed. Don't obey. Don't listen to that email.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's the kind of policy you have to have of anytime you get an email telling you to change, but you know, wire information, you need to call and verify it. And I have had arguments with brokers who say, I don't have time for that. It's like, I don't care. You need to do it. Because if you don't, you are going to end up wiring the value of somebody's house to the wrong bank account, and it's going to disappear, and then somebody just got fucked out of their money. And it's either going to be the buyer, or it's going to be the lender. And in many cases, nobody wants to fuck the buyer over, because now this person just had the value of their house stolen, and they're not going to get their house, and that looks terrible all around. So it usually ends up being one of the companies in the middle. And legitimately, who fucked up, right? So it actually becomes a real question of what happened to that money. And if they're quick about it, by the time you realize something's happened, it's gone, and you will never get it back. And if you call the FBI, they'll take the report, they'll try. And most likely, if they recover any of it, it's going to be a fraction. Because the people stealing that money, they don't care if they burn 3/4 of it hiding how they got it and where they got it from. Because it's all free to them. And even if they don't burn that much of it, if they get most of it, you know, for them, that's a major payday. So this shit happens. I get people forwarding me stuff inside my company all the time saying, hey, can we block this address? Look what they're sending me. And usually it's going to be hey, can we pay this invoice from somebody who doesn't work for the company anymore? You know, they've got an old contact list or something. And like, yeah, yeah,
when
hey.
I was dealing with people rather than paperwork,
mm-hmm.
I had to field several calls of, do we send this here? And like, no, you don't. Where did you get that info? And it's, there wasn't anything compromised on either one's end. They just knew this bank does business with so many people. We're going to pretend to be X Bank.
Get a copy of an email they send out, use it as a template, and send something. Sure.
Oh, it doesn't even need the email. Bank logos are, you see it. It's on your card. It's outside the bank. It's on the stuff they hand out.
Oh, sure.
They just scan a logo and make up an email. Just if you're not an idiot, you can sound convincing enough.
One of my favorite tricks I've seen people pulling lately is they'll just go get into somebody's Gmail account, right? Or set one up, I assume. I don't know. They look like they're hacked email accounts when I see them. But they will change the display name to be like the last name, comma, first name, open bracket, internal email address of that person, close bracket. That's the display name of the email address, right? Like when you set up a new email account, it says, what is your name? And you punch in your real name, because that's what it's going to say the sender is for, like, you know, a work account. They put that whole string in the name field. And then, you know, they just leave the actual from address is the Gmail address. And the actual the reply to is the Gmail address. And then send it as, you know, hey, can we get somebody to pay this consultant who did some private work for me or whatever, you know, bullshit. You know, we need to pay them $30,000 or whatever for a contract. Yeah, it's some of them are really amusing because you get an email, you know, forwarded to you from somebody you know. And it's like they would never use the word kindly. I'm just going to tell you guys right now, the word kindly is a big red flag that is probably not a legitimate email, because that I think that's a weird translation quirk from several other languages, mainly Hindi.
I get those emails all the time. They're legit on my side because I work with Indians all the time.
I was going to say, do you work with people who they natively speak Hindi?
Hell yes.
Yeah.
Kindly do the needful.
Yeah, shit like that. So, but when you get an email from somebody in the office, you know, down the hall, and you know that they're American, and it's got that in there.
My favorite, I don't want to actually use the name that was on there because it would link to a bank, but let's say it's Bob's Bank is the name of the bank.
Sure.
They put an extra S at Bob's. And then they assume that you're just going to read bank no matter what they put there. So instead of an A, it's like an E or a U, .com.
The other one I've seen them do is they'll go register a Yahoo or a Gmail address with the email address of somebody who legitimately works at the company they're going to spoof. The name of the company they spoof, they leave the at sign out. Or they don't. I've seen them where they have the at sign in them, too. You know, and then they leave off the .com. And so the email address ends up being something along the lines of, you know, whatever, you know, at mortgage@gmail.com. And it's just like, you know, when you see the email address, it's like, how are you falling for this shit? But yet people are so busy and so, you know, used to just seeing what they want to see that they don't realize it and they fall for this shit. So I guess we should get back to the article here.
Yeah.
Let's see. After receiving documents that looked legitimate, the county changed the banking information that they would send payments to. Scammers then waited for the county to make their next vendor payment, which allowed them to steal the money. Legitimate requests to update bank information are routine, said the county's announcement. In this case, the request to change branch and associates vendor banking information was made by conspirators. They provided county staff with new banking information, seemingly valid documentation, and signed approvals. You know, so they took an old approval and photoshopped it. I'm almost certain I've seen enough of these that's usually what they do. And if you're familiar with shops, having seen several shops in your time, it's usually pretty obvious that they've shopped it because, like, the font won't match or it won't be lined up right or some other BS. Usually a good thing, good indicator is that the scan is not going to be perfectly straight. And then, you know, whatever information they've changed on the scan is straight. That's usually a pretty good giveaway.
I think that's kind of a BS excuse on their part. Companies, I don't think, change their banks that often.
Well,
once you're an established company.
Well, if you're changing vendors, it's probably not that crazy. But,
well, then you're getting the whole new vendor information. You're not getting two or three different bank accounts from the same vendor.
True, and that's and you know, working in banking myself and seeing this with mortgages mainly, because that's something where you routinely get different banking information. That one, it is routine.
Yeah, well, and that one's because you're sending the money to different customers. They may all have the same real estate agent, but you're not sending it to the agent. You're sending it to Bob. You're sending it to Sue. You're sending it to the person that actually sold the house.
Right. What'd you say, Static?
I'm saying inside job.
Could be. That happens a lot, actually, because they're able to get all the right info to do it.
Local government, they're all corrupt. They don't make enough money off the people in taxes.
Yeah. Oh, yes, they fucking do.
Yeah. After the funds were unknowingly deposited into the scammers' accounts, they were diverted through multiple different accounts, the investigation revealed. The county had not learned of their mistake until almost 3 weeks later when they received a phone call from the legitimate representative of Branch and Associates about not paying them. And that's usually how it's discovered.
And if it's a school construction, one payment might be $1 million. Those are large construction
projects.
This
payment was 2.5.
Yeah.
After learning that they had made a payment to a fraudulent bank account, Cabarrus County notified their banks, who were able to recover a total of $776,518.40 of the stolen $2.5 million. Yeah, here's the quote. The county notified SunTrust, the bank which the funds were transferred, and followed their recommended procedures. Branch and Associates notified Bank of America, the bank to which funds were transferred, which froze the that amount. Because, that's all that they could find in the traceable accounts. The rest of it had already been muled out. And their insurance policy only covered $75,000 of the loss.
Oh, damn.
In order to pay the contractor's invoice, the county had to transfer $1,653,082.60 from the county funds set aside for extraordinary circumstances. In an uncommon glimpse into local politics and BEC scams, a video the county officials explain what happens is... so they've got a video here explaining it. And then they go on to talk about how this kind of scam is out of control and it's costing us, you know, several $100 million a year. And they're right. It is. Don't fucking trust email. Don't do business over email. Seriously.
Or at least verify a change of routing number and account number when you're sending $2 million.
It amazes me, having ran a few different email systems for sizable organizations now, it amazes me what people do over email, what they transact over it. It's like, are you insane? This shit is in clear text. It's going across the internet, across God knows what servers. And you're just, you know, yeah. It's like, you have no way of verifying that email is legitimate. PGP tried to solve that problem a few years ago, and, you know, nobody wanted to deal with it, so... Yeah, Rats is saying, why isn't everybody using PGP? Because it's a pain in the ass. I just saw RU hop into the other channel. You guys want to Shanghai him?
Yeah, we can steal an Australian.
User was moved to your channel.
Excellent timing. We have Shanghai'd an Australian just in time for the Australian story.
Crikey, cunt.
But hey, BSV, you don't have to pretend to have an Australian accent anymore.
Yay.
It's not that you were doing it.
Can I stop drinking the Fosters now, please? Can I stop drinking it?
Yeah, yeah, but we're still going to call you a Kiwi.
Sorry, I missed the show.
We're still going. Dude.
I know I checked, just jumped in. But I was promoting the show as I accidentally threw on my Galaxy 15 shirt as I ran out the door this morning. So explaining to a bunch of young nurses why there'd be free porn and stuff, that got a little awkward. And,
yeah, walk around what in a t-shirt mean, that says robots? Free porn. I mean, you know.
What do you mean the robots are uprising? Yeah, it's an in-joke. Don't worry about it.
Oh, are you? You just started. Rats just asked, where do we get shirts in the IRC?
Oh, dude, I got asked down the game store, too. Where do I get these shirts? And who is
this Galaxy
15?
We need to put them on the website now.
We need a merch store.
They got printed up from a meetup that we did. They're insiders only right now. We may build a merch store.
The guys down the PC world, they love the shirt, man. They thought it was awesome.
What amazed me about that shirt was that was some offhand comment one of us made. I think it might have been me. That Fox was just like, yes, yes. And then the next thing we know, he shows up with that. And it's just like, what the? Wow. These amazing shirts.
Yeah.
So.
But it was all for naught. I didn't drop any blood, and I didn't get my RAM or my mouse. But I did get to see an absolutely cherry 1970 Toyota Celica.
Nice.
Yeah.
So, speaking of Australian...
What's my government done now?
They have a proposal as part of their next... as part of the 2018-2019 budget.
Oh, what are they proposing?
In the and this is from treasury.gov.au, so it's from their website. In the 2018-2019 budget, the government announced it would introduce an economy-wide cash payment limit of $10,000 for payments made or accepted by businesses for goods and services. Transactions equal to or in excess of this amount would need to be made using the electronic payment systems or by check. The Black Economy Task Force recommended this action to tackle tax evasion and other criminal activities. The government has today released for public consultation exposure draft legislation accompanying explanatory material to implement the economy-wide cash payment limit from 1 January 2020 and for certain AUSTRAC reporting entities from 1 January 2021. Submission. So it's a request for public comment, and you know, you can submit responses to this up to the 12th. When was this posted? Submissions are open until Monday. You know, the 12th. This was posted on the 26th of July. So you have 2 weeks, 3 weeks to comment.
Sounds about right.
Before you're not allowed to spend more than $10,000 cash.
But I tell you how that works in the circles that I work in that relies on a lot of cash. Hey, Bob, what do you want, 40 grand for that? Yeah. All right, man, I'll pay you in increments of $10,000.
No, $9,999, you know what I mean? $10,000 and up.
Yeah, dude, that's how this shit works.
It's like, called structuring, but yes, it does. Yeah.
And if your banks are anything like ours, once they see a pattern of that, guess whose account's frozen?
Yeah, but if you're a business that is depositing that sort of money every month.
A deposit's not going to be a problem. It's constant withdrawals just under recording requirements. Because when the business makes a deposit, they're not just depositing your $9,999. They're depositing your $9,999 and then Joe's $45 and Bill's $2,000 or whatever. So their deposit slip's not going to show anything weird, but your withdrawal history can get you flagged.
Brought to you by Australia.
That's why anybody who participates in the black market takes out an X amount of money every fortnight or every week and stashes it.
Yeah, you just have to... break it up a bit more than that whenever you're doing this. It'll take long-term planning to buy something. But
take out 700 here, 10,000 there.
Towards the on some of dystopia. It is at least over here, I know construction, they do some off-the-books work to pad their profits.
Well, I grab 600 a month out in one large hit, and then I do medium size every week consistently, pretty much on the exact same day every day, every week, sorry. So I built up a patent, so it looks like I'm paying rent and then, you know, some cash for walking around during the week. And I pile it up, and then when I take it to America.
Is that not fucked up, though? It's like, yeah, you're not allowed to spend your money.
Well, you want to know how you get a dark economy? You make everything illegal. You make motorbikes fucking illegal. You make quad bikes illegal. Yeah, you make all sorts of shit illegal or have to get government registration. Like the dude I was talking about with that cherry car, man. Fucking 50 grand cash he put into that car. Like, over a year.
Go ahead, BSV. We didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, Australia has this law, but I know, like, here when I got my last car, pretty much they literally shaved off a chunk of it if I paid with cash, because even here, anything over 10,000 or more is flagged for
you have to
possibly
report it.
Illegal
actions. It's not illegal to do it, but you do have to. You have to note it.
Yeah.
But this is saying it's flat out illegal to do it.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm just saying, if you haul out a large amount of cash from your savings or that, it will get flagged for possible stuff.
You're welcome.
Yeah, dealing in cash, it actually takes discipline. You have to build it up. Like with the drain work I had done. Yeah, it's going to cost around $4,000 paying cash. $1,500, done. You know what I mean?
Well, I haven't seen that big of a discount, but I have gotten some discounts for paying cash for work.
The trick there is that they're not depositing it in the bank either.
No.
They're not reporting it to the government as income.
Yeah.
It's the same when I need a skip bin for when I'm doing construction around here. I ring the first time I rang the dude up. I'm like, hey, I need a skip bin. And he's like, yeah, it's going to take about 3 to 4 days. And I said, well, I need it tomorrow. I said, I'm paying cash. He said, I'll be there this afternoon.
It's like, what? Real money? Fuck.
Yeah. I mean, really, this is just a showpiece after the trial of all the banks. Yeah, it's a joke. Anybody who actually does deal in cash isn't worried.
Fair enough. So, all right, let's move on to the next one.
Sorry to let you down there.
No, you're fine. I was legitimately curious if that would even be a thing, or if you. It may not even pass, right? It's just proposed legislation.
Oh no, it'll pass. It'll pass. Anything with more control. It's.
Nah.
Yeah, they're doubling down on the nanny state here right now. They're like, well, the road toll's up. Time to crack down on driver's licenses. Maybe we need to think about 21 years old before people can drive. Maybe every car needs to come with an alcohol interlocker. Maybe all cars need to be speed governed to 100 kilometers an hour. It's just all sorts of stupid shit. It's for your safety and your children.
But maybe all cars should have emergency shutoffs.
Pretty much. Well, I think 110 is our top speed we are allowed to do on any highways in this country.
Yeah.
You know, it's just
70 miles an hour? Oh, God, I would shoot myself driving that slow.
I like what Rats is saying. The IRC Japan has speed limits. It just takes an Arduino to disable it, which that's true. You would create a whole underground economy of people taking governors off their
cars stuff. Here are governed to 180 kilometers an hour right now. But anybody worth their salt, their car does 300 plus.
A lot of our cars, like my car's got a governor on it around, I want to say 140. And I know a car I had before that had a governor on it around 120, but those aren't mandated. That's just the manufacturer putting it in there so you don't, you know, cause the car to blow up.
Well, most of it is because the cars are so poorly designed aerodynamically, the whole chassis starts lifting up when the wind gets underneath it at that speed. No, you may laugh, but I was in an old Ford Fairlane that the dude decided, well, I'm going to open it up on the highway. Just after about 240 kilometers an hour, the whole car started lifting off the ground. Because at that point, we decided we should slow down. Like, nice. If you ever felt a car lift off the ground, you know what I'm talking about. How?
I've gotten that off a few hills before, but not quite like, you know, takeoff. So
yeah.
Next one up.
130 miles an hour on a bike.
It's suicidal. Just riding bikes is crazy.
That same bike you laid down?
I have not laid down a bike. It was blown over. I left it at home. Tornado came through, came back, and was on its side. But I've never laid down a bike.
Oh.
That is Laser that laid down the bike.
Ah, okay.
I'm one of the motorcyclists that is going to lay down a bike. I have not yet done so. Well, there are only two types, those who have and those who are going to.
Fair enough.
Well, it's like people who've had it's like people who've suffered a data breach or a data issue. Either they have or they're going to.
Yeah, so. I mean, I've gotten close on rainy days, coming to a stop at a stop light and not realizing what of an angle I was on the bike. I've slid, but I was able to catch it.
Yeah.
Hopefully mine is done.
Oh, have you gone down too?
Yeah, but it was in a parking lot.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I remember you saying that now, but you weren't going very fast.
Nope. No, like I said, hopefully that is one and done.
All right. You got it out of your system. Don't necessarily have to do it again. So don't.
Yeah. Because we don't want to have to go out there with a shovel. That's one reason a lot of motorcyclists have beards. It's to cover up the scars on their chin.
Yeah. Don't lay the bike down, Static. We don't want to have to go out there with a shovel to scrape up what's left.
I wear a full face mask helmet. So,
oh, cool. We'll find the helmet and whatever's still inside it, and that'll be it. It's like the helmet did its job wonderfully. Look, there's not a scratch on it. Yeah, but it's off of his head. But, the helmet did a wonderful job. Oh, shit. Okay, what do we got? I got
protect
two
the
stories.
Brain. Science wants it.
Say what?
Protect the brain. Science wants it.
Science wants it. Yeah, they're still trying to understand that thing.
No, with stories from the other show, donating to science may not.
I like what Rats just said in the IRC. Uncle told me once that helmets don't save you. They just make it an open casket funeral.
There you go.
This is true.
Yeah.
So, all right. Next article is from the BBC. Chinese vlogger who used a filter to look younger caught in live stream glitch. Whoops. Fans of a popular Chinese video blogger who called herself Your Highness Quao Bulo have been left stunned after a technical glitch during one of her live streams revealed her to be a middle-aged woman and not the young glamour girl they thought her to be.
My makeup fell off.
We're pretending to be virtual people already.
The revelation has led to discussions about standards of beauty across the country's social media. No, it hasn't. The blogger, who initially boasted a follower count of more than 100,000 on Douyu, is believed to have used a filter on her face during her appearances and has been renowned for her sweet and healing voice. China's Global Times said she had been worshipped as a cute goddess by some members of her loyal audience, with some fans even giving her more than 1,000 won, which is like $14,000 or 11,000 euros. However, live streaming platform Leishi News says that the incident happened on the 25th of July during a joint live stream with another user, Quinzgiz, on the Douyu platform. The Global Times reports that all was normal and her fans urged her to show her face and remove her filter, but she refused. Apparently saying, "I can't show my face until I receive gifts more than 1,001. After all, I'm a good-looking host." Followers began sending her donations, with the largest purported to be around 40,000 won, which is about $5,000. Damn.
Some generous pay pigs.
Right? However, at some point, it seemed like the filter being used by the vlogger stopped working and her real face became visible to her viewers. She is reported to have noticed only when people who had signed up to her VIP access room started exiting en masse. Many of her original followers, especially men, are said to have stopped following her and withdrawn their transactions after seeing her true identity. They went and called the credit card company and said the bitch was lying.
Put a stop on it.
Most commentators said her followers were gullible, superficial, and deserved to be tricked into parting with their... Yeah, that's something with the Chinese culture that I don't care for. The whole "you deserve to be tricked into it." Because, yeah. Into parting with her cash gifts without first verifying her identity. Users on both Bible and YouTube have captured footage. Huaobalu has since suspended her platform, according to Weibo users who are debating the impact of what happened. Some users saying it's good riddance to her for conning people out of their money, but others question the IQ of men for throwing money at her. Well, it's not like they were thinking with their brain. Some users are more sympathetic, asking people not to judge her by her appearance, noting that her popularity came from her voice and that she might have to seek therapy after the backlash. And there are some... praising the other live streamer, Quinskig, who showed no reaction to Quagblue's face being revealed. So, live streamers are discouraged from broadcasting in a public sphere. So, okay, anyways. Apparently, she's picked up more followers on her Douyu profile page after she stopped live streaming just because of all the people. But, I just, whoops. So, they've got a screenshot showing what she really looks like on the left, and then one of the filters she was using on the right. And, I mean, I guess it's just one of those face swap things, right? And I know there's lots of apps and things that'll do it, but, I don't think it was using a filter to make her look younger. I think that's just somebody else's face it was pasting over, you know, Snapchat style.
That's quite a big difference.
Now we just need to do some voice modulation in BSV. I think we can start making some decent money.
Yeah, there you go, BSV. You and Madman can go be thoughts on Twitch. There you go. Just message her and ask her what software they were using.
I just don't want to think of Vinnie Peck's Madman Sends Out.
Hey, they'll be very nice. They just won't be mine.
He has a long history of running fake Facebook profiles. It's fine. He knows what he's doing. So, last article I have for tonight, with regards to just straight up news, anybody who was using Amazon Dash buttons, Amazon is turning that service off. So, apparently they are going to disable the capabilities of all the Dash buttons worldwide on August 31st. The decision follows Amazon's move in February to stop selling the new buttons, which I hadn't noticed. At the time, the company folks with existing Dash buttons continue to order stuff with them, but Amazon spokeswoman said the usage has significantly slowed since then, resulting in the company pulling the plug completely on the program. The Dash button, the ultimate single-use device, let you buy an item on Amazon with one click. There was a Dash button for Tide, there was one for Gillette razor blades, there's another for Shiba cat food. Dozens were created as brands quickly saw the button's value, customer loyalty, and creating tiny ads in people's homes. Oh, they're saying Alexa killed it. Too many people are just, you know, yelling at Alexa to order things rather than actually touching a button. I like what Rat says in there. Just open, you know, just open source the things and let people do what they want with them.
So, that'll ever happen.
Yeah, that's probably true. Well, they're probably just like an ESP one and a physical button in there, and that's it. So, you know. Oh, well. But anyways, I just thought that was kind of interesting because, I mean, like, I get what they've got a picture of one stuck on a washing machine with the Tide logo on it. And it's like, you know, I could actually see that. But, of course, I'd be afraid that, you know, I'd have somebody over and, like, knowing some of my friends, if they saw a dash button, they'd just press it every time they walked by, see how they could run my bill up to.
Not just friends who want to put pranks. You have cats.
Well, the cat's not been known for pressing buttons, but I could see it, you know.
Well, have any of your friends smeared tuna paste on any of the buttons in your house before?
No, but I wouldn't put it past you, Madman, somehow. It's like you show up and there's a pallet of cat food on the, you know, it's like, what the fuck?
Trained a cat to push the button to order the cat food.
Trained a cat to flip off light switches by putting bottle caps on them.
So, anyways, yeah, now it's Alexa, so now you just got to worry about somebody doing something like, Alexa, order 500 rolls of toilet paper, confirm. Anyways, so let's do this.
They just start yelling cancel at the top of their lungs.
Got one thing for you tonight in Digital Dojo, and this is just awesome. The article in Extreme Text is talking about it, but it's actually hosted on GitHub. Somebody has there's a version of Diablo, the original Diablo engine. That was put together by Rivsoft that runs entirely in a browser. So Diablo 1 just in your web browser, and we were playing with it earlier, and yes, it works. It'll ask you for the full game MPQ, but if you don't have it, it'll let you play the shareware version. I am certain that if you try really, really hard, you can find a version of that MPQ, or you can go on GOG and buy it. But like everybody, I'm sure like everyone has a couple of copies of the game floating around if you've been playing at all or, you know, have an old computer. So, you know, whatever. But it plays exactly like the game used to on the old, you know, 95 box. So that's pretty cool. And it's hosted on GitHub, so it's probably not going to be blocked at, you know, work. The only thing I didn't think about was multiplayer. I wonder if it supports... I don't know. You wouldn't be able to do network, probably, but it might do Battle.net. Is Battle.net even still up for Diablo 1? Probably not.
Probably not.
But, yeah, I didn't think to go look at multiplayer with it. But, yeah, Rivsoft put this together, and, yeah, if you just go to diablo.rivsoft.net... It'll pull it up and ask you to either select the MPQ or to just play the shareware version. And, yeah, then it just starts up the game, and it's really fun watching how quick it loads, too. So it's just like,
nope,
bang.
Just Diablo 3 on Battle.net.
Oh, yeah, there's probably a way to get the multiplayer on that thing working. So, but anyways, that's all I really have for tonight. We went very long. We're almost at 75 minutes. So, of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Pure decking every Thursday. Of course, the Galaxy 15 site, galaxy15radio.com. You can get in the IRC there. On Freenode, it's the channel Galaxy 15 Radio. Tonight in the IRC, we have myself, Sardonyx, Psychros, DP View, Herats, Iron Angel, and Madman. Speaking of Madman, closing thoughts.
Whenever anyone asks you to change your billing information via email, don't do it.
Please confirm. Make sure an actual human who works at the company you're talking to has told you that, yes, you should do this. And if they have a phone number in the email telling you to change the accounting number, don't call that number. Look up the phone number that you have on file for them already and call that one. But I'm not bitter. Are you? Closing thoughts.
Probably IHN this week, where we put the amateur back into amateur radio, hopefully. I don't know. Are we doing it at the show this week, guys?
I should be around.
Stories. All right. Probably doing it. If not, spay and neuter your pets.
Thank you, Bob Barker.
Why do you want to be an asshole to your dog?
All right, Static, closing thoughts.
I'm in a Diablo dungeon run.
Nice. All right, BSV, what you got?
I have nothing, but that's a different show.
Nice. All right. Of course, I think I'm just going to start playing sounds on the soundboard and close us out.
I have testicular cancer.
That's it, man. Game over, man.
Hit the wrong button there.
Game over.
Time to go nose down and call tonight.
Shut up, Wesley.